People are going without needed care, living in pain with chronic illnesses because they cannot afford medications, and many are going without health insurance overall, with the ER as their only option. I recently had a conversation with Susan at a gathering, and she shared how she needs a monthly inhaler that costs $350 a month. In order to provide for her kids as a single mom, she uses that inhaler 2 to 3 times a week to make it last longer. It is prescribed daily to be effective. She claims she wheezes, but not as much. And when air quality is bad, it is a struggle to breathe. She could put things on a credit card, but doesn't want to deal with a looming fear of debt or worse, bankruptcy. How is it that we live in a thriving country in the USA where people have to choose between caring for their kids, putting food on the table, or purchasing the medication needed? Or as Susan put it, I'm just trying to breathe.
Are you tired of the high cost of healthcare?
Are you overwhelmed trying to navigate a complicated healthcare system?
Welcome to Get Savvy, Demystifying Healthcare Weekly Podcast, where we take complicated healthcare topics and make them simple.
Imagine if you could stop feeling paralyzed with fear and frustration and instead be empowered to make smart healthcare decisions for you and your family.
Get Savvy with your host, Sandy Kibling, a healthcare professional changing how healthcare knowledge is shared.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the show, Medical Debt, What Are Your Options? Medical debt impacts consumers greatly. It can damage or ruin credit records, destroy families' financial stability, deter seeking needed medical treatment, or lead to bankruptcy. There is an estimated $88 billion in medical debt on consumer credit card records nationwide. Overall, an estimated 41% of American adults, or about 100 million people, have medical debt, with 12% of those adults owing more than $10,000, according to a recent report that I've read. Medical debt has significant financial consequences beyond any impact on credit scores. It impacts people buying food for their family, clothing, and other basic necessities, and many have reported that they used all or most of their savings to make debt payments. Medical debt often becomes so crushing that families are forced to file for bankruptcy. In fact, as of this recording, 530,000 families nationwide enter bankruptcy each year due to medical issues and bills. These bankruptcies account for 66.5% of all bankruptcies nationwide. What is going on? I'm excited to have Bob Hertz on the show. Bob is a retired health insurance agent and full-time advocate for health reform. He provides key information so consumers can deal with and prevent medical debt. He also proposes serious legal reforms that will reduce the scandalous medical debt that surrounds us today. Bob brings clarity and real solutions both for the individual patient and for society as a whole. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, we have some issues here based on those statistics. It is just so hard to read. So one of the questions I had is I was reviewing that this morning. What is going on? Why are those stats so high?
That's a very good question. I can think of two major reasons. One is that some people, close to 30 million people in America, still do not have health insurance. And the vast majority don't have a lot of money. So the minute they get any medical care, they're likely to incur medical debt. But that has not changed that much over the years. What's happened in the last 10 years or so has been the spread of high deductible health insurance, where the first $4,000 or in some cases even more of a medical episode has to be paid by the patient. Now, if everybody in America had that much in savings, we wouldn't have a medical debt problem. But Americans as a whole are not very good at saving. And so we have people who don't have $500 for an emergency. They're not going to have $4,000 for a healthcare episode. So no insurance and high deductible insurance are the true causes of the explosion in medical debt.
Now, question for you on that. So, you know, so many people choose that high deductible plan you know, because knowing that there's risks with it, but that the premiums for the other plans are so high, they just can't afford it. So I think the thought that I've heard people say is, well, some coverage is better than no coverage. And, you know, that, but it brings a good point. If they can't afford it, is really some better than none?
That is a common problem. And I'm very sympathetic to the people who get in this situation. Often people are faced with a painful choice, as you describe. I'll use some round numbers. Let's say that a zero deductible policy, the kind many Americans grew up with, frankly, but is hard to find today. Let's say a zero deductible policy costs $700 a month for an individual. That's a huge bite every month out of your assets. But a low deductible policy might cost half that, or a low deductible, 700, a high deductible, 350 a month. Well, it's very understandable that you would choose the high deductible, and in a way, you're betting on yourself. And in many years, you might escape. You might pay the 350 and not have any large claims. But in the year that you have a large claim, you have big problems. And so it's a question of, do you want the pain each month, or do you want the pain if you get sick? If you have a chronic illness, asthma, diabetes, the choices are not that good at all. You're going to have pain every year. And so that is a big problem.
So it's almost, you know, when we think about that open enrollment period, and I know that you get a lot of good advice on that. But I feel that people often do the eye roll because it's so complicated to look at all these different plans. But hearing what you said, it's almost like sitting down, first of all, with, you know, on your computer or with a Word document up or a piece of paper, and really just looking at what your circumstances are as a family. You know, do you have those chronic conditions? You know, what, maybe there's an upcoming planned surgery, or just really evaluating kind of the pros and cons and really identifying what your risk aversion is and maybe what you have in the savings as you kind of look at those plans and determine, you know, what's best for you. Would that be a fair statement?
It'd be a very fair statement. One thing people can do, if you take the high deductible plan for the $350 a month, you've got to put some of the money you just saved into savings. Now, you can get into a lot of details if it's a health savings account or medical savings account or just a passbook savings account at the good old bank. It doesn't matter in a way. There's some tax differences, but not everybody makes a lot of money for tax savings to make a whole lot of sense. So as I remember growing up, there used to be a constant financial piece of advice to have 6 months of saving, 6 months of salary, pardon me, in a savings account. And almost no one I knew did that. But those who did were a lot better off. So that old advice is still true.
Yeah, that's true. So it sounds like the first step in kind of thinking about avoiding that medical debt is, one, finding the right plan for you based on current conditions, your family's needs, et cetera, is the first thing. And it sounds like being aware of that, the risks that are associated with a high deductible plan for sure. So what happens? Let's think about, so let's say that your best efforts were made, but now an individual person or family finds that they're faced with that debt. I mean, what options do they have out there?
That's a very good question. And I'll go through a number of tactics that you can use if you are faced, if you get that bill and you can't pay it off. So what do you do? Number one, read the bill. It's very understandable that you would see this horrible total on the bottom, $12,000 or whatever it is or more, and think, this is horrible. It's the end of life. And I understand that feeling. But what you got to do is slow down, read the bill. Secondly, call the provider. Ask the provider if they have submitted the bill to your insurance company. It's because the volume of paperwork is so high, and because of the complexities, and because no one's perfect, sometimes you'll get a bill for $12,000 and it hasn't even gone to your insurance company yet. And if and maybe the insurance company is going to pay $10,000 and you don't even know that yet. Some providers, I ran into one once myself. I'm on Medicare, but many of the same issues show up on Medicare. Some providers will send the bill immediately to you in hopes that you'll pay it all. And then it won't even get to your insurance. And the provider is happy because they got the whole amount from you. So that's quite rare, I think. But it's duplicitous, and you must call them out on it. So step two, send the bill, make sure the bill has gone to your insurance company. Step three is to talk to the provider right away. You can negotiate. Americans, as a rule, are not that good at negotiating. We don't like negotiating as a whole. I mean, obviously, some of us do. My father-in-law used to brag how well he negotiated his new car purchases. You know, I got the better of that guy. But most of us, and in fact, not only do we not like it, there's a whole consumer segment of car companies that do not have negotiations. And that appeals to a lot of people. When we go into Walmart and the price of a can of or a case of Pepsi is $6, we want it to be $6 at the checkout line. We don't like to do what happens in some countries where you negotiate everything. Anyways, we really don't like to negotiate medical bills. But you have to swallow and call the provider and say, number one, this is awfully high. And number two, if it can't be changed, can we talk about a payment plan? It's important to recognize this fact, and I'm going to get into credit scores now, not the actual scores themselves. But the fact is this: the provider, the doctor, the hospital, the clinic, they are not the ones who normally report you to the credit score companies. It takes the doctor or hospital giving up on collecting money and selling your debt to a collection agency. And the collection agencies, as a rule, are the ones who report you to the credit scoring bureaus. So do what you can to keep from getting sent to a collection agency.
Well, those are some good tips. You know, a couple things that would come to mind. You know, one of the things that I used to work for a health insurance company, and my team, one of the main things that we did was to troubleshoot complaints that we received from our subscribers about a bill. And what I've uncovered is there is such a high error rate, whether it comes from the provider's office or the health insurance company. I say all day long, trust but verify. They can, and maybe some mistake charge for you had an x-ray for the left ankle and the right ankle when you really only had a left ankle done. And so you have to really verify and look at that and be your own advocate on that piece. And two, you're right. I think it is rare that happens where they don't run it through the insurance company more due to first before billing you, because I think that they would be breaching their contract terms. But I've seen everything, and I can't agree with you more that you have to really verify that piece of it. I often think of my mom, who is just like, oh my gosh, I've got the bill, I have to pay it. But I think, you know, taking that pause, looking at it, if you see something that's different or off, make sure you double check that as well. So such an important facts. And you're right about the negotiation. I recently came back from Cancun, and I was negotiating on a price for some photos that we had done. And it's not a comfortable feeling. You just, you know, here we pay the price that we see on the invoice. But and when it comes to, you know, healthcare, sadly, we really have to evaluate that. And one other point I'd add is I often find that people get confused because they often get that patient estimate from the provider's office for that service. Let's say the service is going to be $8,000. And then they get their explanation of benefits and they see now it's been run through the insurance and now it's $2,000. And they often get confused by the patient estimate versus that explanation of benefits. So we'll put in some resources in the show links to help folks with that. But again, I think it's taking that pause, evaluating, not knee-jerking and paying that right away, but looking at your options. So key points that you provided today. That said, I mean, why are we, it's crazy that we're in this situation that we have to negotiate, we have to verify, we have to double, triple check. Are there any laws out there that protect or that you see on the horizon that really, protect patients and potentially alleviate any medical debt consumers might face?
There actually are not very many laws. A recent court case in your state, Colorado, went to the Colorado Supreme Court. And in this case, a patient went into the hospital with an estimate. I mean, they talk about doing everything right. They asked for an estimate beforehand. And the care that was done pretty much tied into the estimate, but the hospital billed them an extra $100,000. And they had a jury trial and they won. The hospital appealed to the next circuit court and then the hospital won. And finally, an angel of an attorney, an attorney who wanted to make a name for themselves, because most attorneys can't make much money on this kind of case. An angel of an attorney took the case all the way to the Colorado Supreme Court. And I'm getting to the point here. The issue became when the person went into the hospital, they had to sign a form. And I signed one for my wife when we had our children, and I signed one for myself when I had a lung surgery. And the form says, I agree to pay whatever's billed. I mean, it has other language, but if you read it, frankly, that's what you have. And the attorney for the lady said she couldn't have known about this huge extra fee when she signed that form. So if the form is invalid and you must charge her the normal rate, and she won. But it took several years and a good attorney, so I can't recommend that as a standard procedure. Here are some things you can do when you are faced with this, and I'm using let's call it negotiation to use the term broadly. One is that you can go to the newspapers. If it's an egregious case of price gouging, newspapers like those stories and hospitals hate them. I can't tell you how many times I've read in the literature, and doing what I do, I read a lot of this literature. How many times I've read where the day after a story hit the newspaper, the hospital forgave the bill. So you can go to the newspaper. Another fact, again, is to prevent that collection agency from getting involved, is to go to a payment plan. And it's not widely known. The Affordable Care Act has language that a nonprofit hospital must offer some financial assistance to anyone with an income under 400% of poverty, which for, I believe, or 300 or 400, which for a family of four is about $90,000. It may not be much aid, but it's some. In other words, after the fact, if your income is under that poverty level, you can ask the hospital for aid. Hospitals don't like doing this. They put paperwork obstacles in your place. You may have to dig up W-2s and pay stubs. I did it for one of my sons, by the way, who was injured and had no insurance. And I got it done. I got the bill forgiven. But I know what I'm doing, and it took me several hours of work. So there are techniques, but there are not a lot of them.
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I know that some people may not know of, and I personally just won my case on this one, was with the No Surprise Act law that went into effect on 1/1/2022. I think it's a step in the right direction, but in short, it says that it gives you protection against out-of-network bills. You're in a car accident, you're transported to out-of-network hospital. It gives you rights and protections against that exorbitant bill that you might receive. So I think I'll put a link to it. There's an episode that I talk about the No Surprise Act, but it's good to be informed on that. In short, I recently had received a bill from a pathologist that was out overly inflated big time. And I took it to my local state agencies, and I also took it to CMS, Centers for Medicare Services, and they found in my favor. And like you, I had signed an out-of-network, I will pay the out-of-network cost, but how I won my case was that while I signed that document, what I didn't sign was, and I'm waiving my No Surprise Act right. And where Center of Medicare found in my favor was that this office for the pathology group did not provide me a good faith estimate prior to those services. And because of that, they were in fault per the federal law. And I'm now working with a provider to, because I did pay it because I wanted to avoid going into collections. But I am now working with them to get reimbursed and working with these agencies. And indeed, if they don't follow through, I'll file a complaint with the Center for Medicare. But it's a lot of work, you might be saying, as you listen to this, but I wish there were more laws out there. But I think you have to be your own advocate, because sadly, we live in a healthcare system that's based on quantity and not quality. And you have to do some of these, I call it mental gymnastics, to get yourself through it. But you have to fight the good fight for yourself to avoid that. So just a side note on the No Surprise Act. Do you have any comment on that? Or have you heard any additional stories on how the No Surprise Act is protecting individuals?
Yes, the No Surprise Act was a strong and a good piece of legislation at the end of 2022, which stated that if a hospital tells you they're a network, that everybody who works in that hospital must be in the network, so that you can't go in thinking, oh, I'm in the Blue Cross network. Blue Cross is the big insurer in Minnesota. I'm in the Blue Cross network. And so my anesthesiologist, my surgeon, everybody is in Blue Cross, and my $500 deductible will apply to all of them. And what has happened in some hospitals is that some of the employees and the ambulance companies make sure that they are out of network so they can bill you whatever they feel like. The new law placed serious restrictions on that. And it remains to be seen if it will work. So far in 2023, and we're not that far into 2023, there are, I think it's over 500,000 challenges throughout the country to hospitals and to anesthesiologists based on this law, and how there will be penalties and how it will be handled. There are a couple of solutions. It's tragic. I mean, we must take a step back. Here we have something, and this is how I got into my focus on medical debt. Here we have something that's supposed to be a charitable giving profession. Medicine is a healing profession. What are the doctors, what's their first oath? Do no harm. And that should apply financially. Doctors are marvelous. They apply it physically, but they don't always apply it financially. And so it's tragic that we have to be so adversarial in this country against medical providers. And we should take a lesson from some other large countries. For example, in France, there are co-payments in France. It's not a free ride. But if you have a chronic illness such as diabetes, you're exempt from co-payments right from the start. In Germany, there are deductibles, but the maximum deductible is $600 for the year. And so these are legislation. It would take a lot of guts on legislators' parts, which is not always in great supply. But These things are possible. Another idea was proposed by Hillary Clinton in 2016. We're so deep into the election controversies, we've kind of forgot about 2016. And she was not a perfect candidate, but she had one proposal that I thought made a lot of sense. And that proposal was, if you got a medical bill of any kind that exceeded, I think it was 10% of your income, you could apply for some free government aid. So in other words, if your income was $50,000 and you got a bill for $10,000, and that was more than 10% of your income, you could apply for a fixed amount of basically government cash. And no, it was not free. It would have cost some billions of dollars. But since we're not going to have the wide global legislation that I just described to make us like France or Germany, an extra few thousand dollars would really help.
Absolutely. You know, kind of leads to my next question. You know, when we talk about, I think of healthcare reform, you know, we talk about how it's broken. We talk about how sad the circumstances are. I look back and think about healthcare reform overall. I know Hillary Clinton tried to do a lot with that, but I think about healthcare reform. I mean, our first major healthcare reform occurred in 1965 with the creation of Medicare. And then we had the next, and a reform I'm referring to overall, not like state mandates that put a cap on insulin. Those are great, but I'm talking an overhaul of the system. So the first occurred in 1965, and then the second occurred with Affordable Care Act in 2010, 45 years later. And so I look at the current circumstances, although I tend to avoid political conversations, but oh my goodness, I don't think there's going to be healthcare reform on the horizon, sadly, in our lifetime. And it's such a sad state of affairs. But I think what it lends itself to, it goes back to what we've been saying is, you know, two things. One, you know, being your own advocate, being aware of the options that are available to you. Maybe they're limited, but you do have rights. And so I think that becomes important because, again, there's no reform out there. So you have to look at those options available. And leading to my next question is, you know, given the circumstances we're up against, what can be done to protect patients' rights from your view?
I think the first thing is to look at those authorization forms that I just described mm-hmm. and have a national law on what those mean. The forms, I think, were originally designed, I'm not positive, but I think they were originally designed to enable the medical professionals to do whatever it takes to save your life. That if you go in, I had a crisis about 8 years ago and all I had was an infection in my foot. And I went in, urged on by my mother. I was saying it'll go away. And she was saying, no, it might not. Get down there. And so I went into the emergency room and it turned out I had sepsis, which could be fatal. And so they had to do a number of things, and they saved my life. So the forms were designed for that. These financial blank checks have probably been added since. So the first thing to do is to clean up those forms. A second thing to do is to take a law from Medicare. In Medicare, if you go in for a treatment of any kind, hospital, doctor, and the doctor files a claim with Medicare, and the claim is denied, and you, the patient, had no way of knowing that it maybe wasn't covered under Medicare, you do not have to pay. You have no liability. So that could be extended to under age 65 also. A lot of medical debt comes from people who thought they had insurance, and they paid their premiums, but due to some technicality, it might have been the fault of the doctor, or it might have been stickiness by the insurance company, their claim was denied, and so they're on the hook. That doesn't have to be. That could be another law change. A third area is not really a law, but I want your good listeners to be aware of this. there is an organization, and I helped support it, called RIP Medical Debt. RIP Medical Debt is an organization headquartered in New York, which buys old medical debts and forgives them. And they get charitable contributions, usually from churches. And they then have the ability to buy medical debts. If I have time, I can explain how they can do it. Should I go ahead?
Sure, absolutely.
Let's talk about the life of a medical debt. You go into the hospital, you have a high deductible or no insurance, and there's a $10,000 debt. Hospitals don't collect very much on old debts. They call you, they write you letters. In the worst cases, they sue you. They collect at most 10 or 15% of those debts. So maybe the hospital can only collect $1,000 out of your $10,000. Even though it's caused you great harm, hurt your credit rating, and all that. They might sell that debt to a collection agency for $2,000, maybe less. Because the collection agency says, yeah, we'll pay you $2,000, but we're better, we're meaner. That's what it comes down to. And we'll go in and collect more of that debt. And so what RIP Medical Debt does is that they will go to the collection agencies and say, have you got some old debts that you're not making any progress on either? Sell them to us. And then when they've bought the debt, they write a letter to the individual. And the letter is like, you know, a speech from God saying your debt is forgiven. RIP Medical Debt has been around for 6 or 7 years. They got a huge infusion of cash from Mackenzie Scott, the wife of Jeff Bezos, because in the divorce settlement, she received billions of dollars for charity, or which she uses to give to charities. So is that a solution for everyone? No. But if you want to do something about this, even though you don't have medical debt yourself, read up on RIP Medical Debt, and your church or social group can donate a few thousand dollars and make a difference to people's lives.
Yeah, that's amazing. I did not know about that. And that's what I think about every day, and what I try to do with this podcast as well, is that there are so many options that are out there that people just don't know, and they're busy lives and overwhelmed when they get a bill, and who has time to research. So that is such a valuable resource. I so appreciate that. You know, I wanted, as we kind of get to a close, I wanted to talk to you about, you have your website, again, we'll link to the Anti-Debt Agenda, but just kind of some closing thoughts of how you started to do, what made you start to create this this website and your goals to help people, kind of what spurred you to do this?
Well, thank you. I worked in an insurance agency before I retired that handled a lot of cases for the Affordable Care Act, what's also known as Obamacare, which enables people who are not offered insurance at their place of work, or they're self-employed, they don't have a place of work, or they're unemployed, it enables them to get coverage, whereas they used to not be able to get it or afford it. And I was what you might call a navigator. A navigator interviews people in person before the pandemic or on the phone to get their circumstance and recommend an Obamacare plan for them. And that's where people would tell me about their problems that they'd encountered with their insurance, or when they had no insurance. So I listened to a lot of these cases. Then I read an article, I think this was in the run-up to 2020. Bernie Sanders went to a speaking event, and a man came up to him and said, Senator Sanders, I need help with my medical debt. And he said, how much is it? And the man said, it's $139,000. And Senator Sanders says, well, how can you pay it? And the man says, I can't. I'm going to kill myself. And that Well, I don't think he did, but that struck me in one episode of what's wrong with our current system.
Wow, that's amazing. Well, so appreciate some of the things that you are doing and certainly being on the show today, but just the things that you are continuing to do to bring awareness and bring those voices to light. Because I think the what we need to do is rise up. You know, as mentioned earlier, there's no reform on the horizon. I think it's providers and I think it's consumers to rise up and bring awareness to this issue. And one voice at a time to bring about the much needed change is so important. So I really appreciate your time today, but I also want to thank you for the stuff that you're doing. And I know you have more knowledge than we've covered today. So we had to talk about having you on for a second episode and to share the valuable knowledge that you have. So I can't thank you enough for being on the show today. And any final closing thoughts before we wrap?
No, I thank you for talking to me. I hope your Colorado Rockies can get a little better. My Minnesota Twins are doing just fine. Thank you.
I hope so too. Well, thank you, Bob. I appreciate your time.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bob provided some great words of wisdom that hopefully helps you if you are struggling with medical debt. Make sure you check out his resources so you can stay informed and empowered to make smart healthcare choices. In our next episode, we will hear from David Bernstein, MD, specializing in internal medicine and geriatrics. He talks about, I've got some good news and some bad news. You're old. Or tales of a geriatrician. But he also talks about the five smart things you can do to live your best life. Until then, get savvy.